Welcome into the Sunday Spotlight. I'm your host, WECO News Director Aaron Harvey, and joining me now is David Jenkins. And David is the president of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. And just recently, he's on to talk to us because something has happened with the EPA that he says is a good thing. Mr. Jenkins, how are you this morning?
Just fine. Thanks for having me.
I'm very glad to have you on our program, and why don't you go ahead, because I can do it all day. You've got an impressive list of credentials, but why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and how you're highly qualified to talk on this subject?
Well, I'm president of an organization called Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship, as you mentioned, and our organization is an organization of people who are conservative who also recognize that conservation and good stewardship are conservative values. And so we work to promote that. And so that's one of our big things right now, is to make sure that other fellow conservatives understand sort of, you know, what good stewardship is and what it looks like, and not always get caught up in some of the partisan back and forth that we sometimes hear. Also, from a personal perspective, I was heavily involved in 1998 when we negotiated a reduction in the effluent from the Canton paper mill into the Pigeon River. And so I worked on Clean Water Act related things for quite some time. So I, you know, and especially from an East Tennessee perspective, that Pigeon River is a very important part of this.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. All right. So you're here today to talk about something that, a decision that just went on with the EPA regarding wetlands. Talk about what just happened.
Okay. Well, EPA just, back in late May, announced a rule that, basically, establishes the scope, their view of the scope of the Clean Water Act. It'd be what the regulations will say is the scope of the Clean Water Act. And that was thrown into question somewhat, not with respect to actual, you know, the original Clean Water Act, but just because of a Supreme Court ruling where you had a three-way split where there was no majority decision back in a case in 2006 called Rapinos versus EPA. And basically in that ruling, there were three different opinions, and none of them carried the majority. So that sort of threw the interpretation of the Clean Water Act into limbo. And so over the years since, developers and others, and even, you know, people who legitimately need to worry about what they do with respect to discharging into a water body or dealing with wetlands or whatever, it's been kind of a wild west. No one's really known what the rules are, and EPA's been reluctant to enforce to a certain level because of that uncertainty in different regions doing different things and so forth. So this rule was very much needed, and it was long overdue because this court case happened in 2006. But what we're out here trying to point out to people, there's, you know, anytime this administration or one of its agencies comes out with something, we get a lot of sort of knee-jerk reaction on the Republican side of the aisle because, you know, people just have an assumption that anything coming out of this administration has got to be bad, right? But in this case, with the Clean Water Act rule, we think EPA got it exactly right. And the reason we think that is they held true to the intent of the architects of the Clean Water Act. And one of those architects was Howard Baker, Senator, you know, longtime senator from Tennessee and President Reagan's former chief of staff. And he was one of the crafters of the Clean Water Act. And he made it clear not only through his work on crafting the act, but also in subsequent years when there were efforts to narrow the scope of the Clean Water Act, he made it abundantly clear that he believed that in order to protect any of our waterways, we have to protect all of our waters. And he specifically talks about marshes, wetlands, small streams, and so forth. And, you know, if American Farm Bureau and the home builders and stuff are out there doing is they're trying to say that the Clean Water Act needs to be limited to what it calls navigable waters. And in their interpretation of the word navigable, they mean basically, large water bodies that, you know, people can boat in, and in some states are only the ones that are affected by the ebb and flow of the tides and so forth. And if you had that kind of interpretation of the Clean Water Act back when we were working on the Pigeon River issue in 98, you know, EPA wouldn't have had jurisdiction over the section of the river that flows through the paper mill in Canton.
All right, so this new thing, and let's look at this. This is a very complicated issue. What just happened with the Environmental Protection Agency is this new clarification of what is a navigable water. And 299 pages is what I'm seeing that this is. It's a whole new bill. Is it possible that in this 299 pages that the water actually, pun intended, becomes a little bit muddier?
From my reading of the rule, and there's a lot of, there's pages there, but a lot of it is the sites, citing research and that kind of stuff, that the basic thrust of the rule is that it clearly defines, for example, how far from the mean high water mark if a water body has to be considered part of the, under the scope of the Clean Water Act. It puts forth very clear guidelines as to what constitutes something that EPA considers under the jurisdiction of the Act. Whereas before, all the way up until 2006, actually the interpretation of the Clean Water Act was much looser and not well defined as it is in this new rule. There was no stipulation as far as nexus to a larger water body. It was just basically whatever EPA deemed, should be under the Act. They just made a snap ruling as to what was under the Act, and there was very broad guidance there. This is actually more narrow than before the 2006 ruling, and it's more well-defined and clear, so it's easier for a builder or a farmer or whoever to understand what they have to do. And we really want to make sure that's the case, because the things like wetlands and small streams, they perform these services. Wetlands hold water. They prevent flooding. They also release water slowly, which helps with times of drought and low flow. They filter water and help clean it. And when we allow people to get rid of to pave over wetlands or fill in wetlands or fill in headwater streams, what we do is we create a need for additional infrastructure to do what the wetlands were doing for free. And the American Society of Civil Engineers estimates just what we have now, because we've gotten rid of about 50% of all of the wetlands in our nation. What we have now in terms of flood control, wastewater, and drinking water infrastructure that we've had to create will cost us taxpayers, more than $2 trillion over the next 10 years to adequately maintain that kind of infrastructure. From a fiscal conservative perspective, my question is, why would we want to create a nightmarish network of infrastructure to replace something that nature actually produces for free?
Right. That is David Jenkins. He is the president of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. We've got three more seconds with him. We'll get more into this very complex issue in just a moment. You're listening to the Sunday Spotlight on WECO. Welcome back into the Sunday Spotlight. I'm your host, WECO News Director Aaron Harvey, joined by David Jenkins. He is the president of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. We're talking about an EPA decision that just recently happened to better clarify what a navigable water is, because didn't really have much clarification in that before. And so some opposition to this, and the main opposition is that, from what I can tell, a couple of the main oppositions to it are that developers are going to have a hard time developing around what is now defined as wetland or a navigable water. So they're having to, I don't know, work a little bit harder and maybe invest a little bit more to get that done. But your answer to that opposition is that it's better for the country, it's better for the environment, and it's better fiscally for the country. Is that correct?
Yeah, certainly. It's obviously better for the environment. It's better fiscally, as I mentioned before the break, with respect to reducing our need for infrastructure when we allow people to sort of willy-nilly fill in or destroy or pollute these water resources. We have to somehow, you know, deal with that impact as it goes downstream. And the other impact that I never hear really discussed, and it seems to be something obviously the builders and the American Farm Bureau want to avoid, is that, you know, this is also a property rights issue. And from the standpoint of, if you're a downstream landowner or business owner, and someone upstream fills in the wetlands, the headwater wetlands, and as a result, rainwater runs off faster and floods your property more frequently, or rainwater runs off faster and then in times of drought, you have such a low in-stream flow that you can't irrigate your crops or you can't, you know, water your livestock or whatever the case may be. That is an imposition on your property rights that someone upstream of you imposed on you. And President Reagan called that the destructive trespass of pollution. And, you know, looking at quotes from Howard Baker and others who helped create the Clean Water Act, they clearly understood that reality, and they understood that all the water bodies are connected, and you can't protect a bigger body of water and make it fishable, swimmable, if you don't also protect all the feeder streams that feed into it or the wetlands that help hold and filter the water. So, you know, a lot of people try to make this a property issue with respect to, you know, oh, EPA is going to make us jump through a hoop and get a permit before we can do X, Y, or Z. Well, that's just minuscule compared to the fact that, you know, someone upstream is able to greatly impact not only your property and use of your property, but in some cases with some of the flooding we've seen recently, your livelihood, your safety, and your ability to even occupy your property.
Now, how does this affect someone who owns property around a wetland, has a wetland on the property, maybe has several, just not commercially, just residentially, and let's say they want to do anything at all that could possibly affect a wetland. What if they don't know about this? Does it make it illegal for them to try to develop even a residential structure?
Well, yeah, you're supposed to, you have to get a county permit or, you know, building permits and things like that. Somewhere along the way, you know, hopefully you would be made aware of the need to get permission before you fill in a wetland. But if the wetland is within the scope covered by this, which, you know, where it has a close nexus to another water body, yeah, you would need to get a permit before you could actually destroy and you fill in part of that wetland for your use. And, you know, it may be a little bit extra hoop to jump through, but would we really want it so that anyone could just do that without anyone looking at the impacts to people downstream? You know, rivers and streams, they don't respect political boundaries. They don't stay within a county. They don't stay within a state. And so, just like with the Pigeon River situation, you have a company polluting it right before it crosses the state line. And if you didn't have someone like EPA, and this can only be done at the federal level, President Reagan even said that, if you don't have the EPA looking over this, then that company can do whatever it wants to, and there is absolutely no recourse. You know, you just throw yourself on the mercy of the state that the facility happens to be in or the landowner happens to be in. Yeah. Otherwise, you have no recourse. You just have to live with it. And I would think that most of the people that live along the Pigeon River in Newport and other places in East Tennessee would want someone to be looking out for their downstream interest, their safety, their health, their property rights, and so forth.
So you're saying people have to go get a building permit anyway.
Who has to know this?
Will it be up to the residential owner to know this, or will somebody come out and say, hey, wait a minute, I know that this large document just passed, and we're going to have to look into that and make sure that you're not too adjacent to a larger body of water?
Well, in most cases where you've got building, where you've got the actual filling in of wetlands, it's actually not the individual homeowner doing it. It's usually a development company, company that builds homes for a living or builds strip malls or whatever the case may be, and they certainly know how to deal with all kinds of federal, state, and local permits. If it is an individual, if you look at the record and even before, when the rule, the guidelines for the Clean Water Act was interpreted even more loosely, if a landowner, does something inadvertently, but they're willing to cooperate with EPA once they find out about the rule, usually things are worked out. It's only those people who decide, it's going to be my way and I don't care what happens to the people downstream or the impacts to, the waters that after they flow off of my property. Those people then can get hit with fines and forced to reverse whatever it is they did. The first President Bush, enacted a policy of no net loss of wetlands, where he said that what he wanted was that our country, if a wetland is compromised, that then there's some mitigation, some other wetland created so that your general overall area of wetlands, don't diminish, as we go forward in time, any further than the 50% that we've already lost.
All right, that's David Jenkins. He is the president of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. We've got him for two more segments here on the Sunday Spotlight on WECO. Welcome back to the Sunday Spotlight. My guest today, David Jenkins. He is the president of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. We're talking about wetlands and basically what we touched on last segment, just telling people, hey, don't freak out. Especially residential people, don't freak out, because this mostly won't affect you. It is for the developers of companies coming in. And there's a lot politically going on. People talk about state rights and personal rights. And, I mean, you've seen all that. I don't want to get into a debate about the Confederate flag and things of that nature, but I do want to ask this, because it is something you've talked on before, and that's that to the layperson, normally when you think about environmental rights and environmental protection, normally I think to the common person that's not really involved in politics at all, most people think that that is a pro-democratic issue, and you talk about traditional conservatives and the traditional Republican Party. Talk about that perception that quote tree huggers are mostly of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's a perception that has really sort of come into play in the last 25 years. If you look back throughout history, Republicans actually have a stronger environmental record than Democrats. Go back to, Abraham Lincoln that first protected Yosemite National Park. It was Ulysses S. Grant that first created our first national park with Yellowstone. Theodore Roosevelt did all sorts of things, creating the Forest Service and the Antiquities Act and protecting all these national monuments. And, he was just a visionary when it came to good stewardship. Then you go forward and you look at Hoover followed suit with a lot of national park stuff. A guy named John Saylor, who was a congressman, very conservative, anti-communist congressman from Pennsylvania, had an instrumental role in the Wilderness Act and the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and then you get to Nixon, and you get to the Republicans in Congress during the time that Nixon was there. And Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. We got, you know, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, all those, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, all under Nixon administration's watch and the Congress that was in place at that time. And then, you know, look at it from a Tennessee perspective, you know, Howard Baker was instrumental in a lot of those laws. And you've seen Lamar Alexander also carry on the tradition of looking out for downwind states with respect to the mercury rule and things like that, which he's taken some flak for. But this is a whole republic, and President Reagan, for example, you know, he's the one who helped solve the ozone depletion, the ozone hole that people used to hear about in the 80s. Because he worked hard to push through a treaty, international treaty that phased out the use of something called fluorofluorocarbons, which eroded our protective ozone layer. So and then H.W. Bush, who did the Clean Air Act amendment and the no net loss of wetlands policy that we were talking about. So there is a long Republican history of this. And the problem is there's some people in charge today that have a very different view of things. They're very libertarian in their outlook. It's like, you know, let me do what I want to and leave me alone. And I kind of compare that to the philosophy of the hippies of the 1960s, which was, if it feels good, do it. And to me, that's not conservative. And if you look throughout history and you look at the quotes of luminaries in the conservative field and people who actually are credited with sort of the advent of conservative political thought, they would be appalled at that kind of notion. A writer named Russell Kirk, who Reagan and Nixon both praised as the philosopher of modern conservatism, he said that the devil was the first libertarian, because that attitude of do whatever I want to, don't respect authority, if it feels good, do it. You know, there's nothing conservative about that. Whether it's people on the right professing it or whether it's people on the left professing it, it's the same ideology, and it's morally bankrupt. It doesn't reflect true conservative values that are steeped in you know, history and even biblical teachings.
So if you have a modern-day Democratic Party that thinks we should protect the environment, you have a classical, traditional Republican Party that got a lot of stuff done in the stewardship of the natural lands, then what you're basically saying is this really should be bipartisan and everybody should be on board with this.
Yeah. You know, President Nixon said there's a cause beyond party and beyond faction. And Reagan said something similar. He said, that this is not a partisan issue, it's common sense. So we, you know, how do we go from there, where we have conservatives and Republicans coming up with great ideas and innovative ways to deal with issues, and solve these problems, to basically handing it over to the Democrats and saying, okay, you're the ones who are, have all the proposals to protect the environment, and we're just going to try to stop you. How does that help? What the American public needs are both parties searching for solutions to problems. And, you know, just objecting to something knee-jerkly because it happens to be the other side that's initially concerned with the problem. I mean, Al Gore was the first person to come out really, in a big public way when he was a senator and complain about, ozone depletion. Well, he complained about it, but it was President Reagan who actually solved it. Reagan didn't say, oh, I'm not going to do anything on this issue because Gore's out here talking about it. He was a leader and a statesman, and he realized that this was a threat, and he wanted to make sure that, as Secretary of State George Shultz said, that we have an insurance policy to protect ourselves from the harm that we might be doing.
There you go. That's David Jenkins, President of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. One more segment with him coming up on the Sunday Spotlight on WECO. Do you have a number, an estimate about how much this is going to save the taxpayer?
Nothing other than what I was talking about earlier, the fact that what we have so far is going to cost us over $2 trillion just to maintain it over the next decade or two. And so why would you add to that? I mean, each project is different. Each wetland, each time you lose wetland, they have, somewhat of a different impact. So, but the cost associated with this rule is really minuscule. It's basically, some extra permitting and stuff that people might have to go through it, but that's important to protect the downstream property owners and to keep us from having to build this infrastructure that, not only we have to pay for, but our children and our grandchildren will be maintaining forever.
Welcome back into the final segment of the Sunday Spotlight. David Jenkins joins us this morning. He's the president of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. And just to reiterate, I think the main point of all of this, and that is some people are saying, hey, this is going to cost us a ton of money to try to build the infrastructure to make up for these wetlands, where before we didn't have to really do that, but now we're having to build stuff to keep doing what the EPA wants us to do. But really, this could save the taxpayer a lot of money, according to you, right?
Yeah, and I don't think there is any infrastructure that really needs to be made unless people wipe out a wetland and they have to create an artificial wetland to mitigate what they did. The real cost is that if you get rid of these wetlands that perform these functions for free, preventing flooding and filtering water and releasing water slowly in times of drought and so forth, if you get rid of these functions and you pave over things, then you're going to have to build infrastructure downstream that's going to have to replace the functions of those wetlands. And that costs a lot to build, it costs a lot to maintain, and it's not just us that's going to be bearing that burden. It's not this generation, but our children and our grandchildren will also have that burden. And, anybody who wants to reduce their tax burden and not pay us so much in taxes, they ought to be happy to let free natural features like this perform these functions and leave them alone, as opposed to having us have to build a lot of things to replace that function that we've carelessly eliminated by paving over wetlands and filling in small streams or even polluting headwaters.
David Jenkins, President of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship. Stay up to date with the Conservative Stewards by going to conservativestewards.org, and you'll get all the information of anything that changes for environmental protection. And I know that you stay on board with that. You're very passionate about it, as anyone can tell by listening to this. And we thank you very much for joining us and educating all of us on this issue.
Well, thank you for having me.